I am Frances Akeley Lance. This is January 18th, 1989. And I'm interviewing John D. Paulson, former editor of the Fargo Forum. John, there's a long-time history of journalism in your family. I remember as far back as high school when your nickname was Scoop.
To some people.
And still called that, I believe. So you've been in this profession for quite a few years. You might say it's even in the genes. But how did you develop your interest in your chosen profession?
I was kind of led along by a very friendly and firm hand, my father. He was the editor of the Forum, and I realized that he was the editor of the Forum from, let us say, the time I was 6 or 7 years old. He was born in Grand Forks, Dakota Territory, and forced to go into earning a living for his family when he was in the ninth grade, making about $2 or $3 a week, sweeping out the paper, and then he graduated to being a reporter and city editor of the Grand Forks Herald in his in the early teens, one Norman B. Black came into Grand Forks as a manager of the Herald and worked closely with Dad. Dad moved to Fargo as city editor of the Forum in 1916. On February 29 of that year, if the leap year makes any particular impression. And a year later, the same Norman Black bought the Forum. He had quit the Herald and gone to work for the conservative Republicans aligned against the Nonpartisan League. And to what extent his activity was in that field had anything to do with his Forum purchase, I don't know, and there's no record of it. But even when he was in Grand Forks, he had pointed a finger at the map of North Dakota and said, Fargo, now that's the place that's going to go. It's a crossroad of two major railroads. And so he came into Fargo. And that was in April 1917, and he sold 20% of the shares in the Forum to my dad and 20% to his own son, Norman D. Black. For convenience sake, when I talk about the Black family, I call him Norm number one, Norm number two, and then Norm number three, who was essentially my compatriot in age and assignment, because he too went to work for his father in the business office and became publisher in 1944 when his father died from early in life or mid-50s. And so Norm number three and I were active participants together until he too died of a early indisposition in the mid-50s. So I stayed on and have worked with his successor, his son-in-law, Bill Marseille, until retirement at the end of 1980. So I've been retired for 8 years.
So your father, with gentle persuasion, or was that where your interest lay early, got you involved in the business?
Well, he made it his business to see that I was involved. He, for instance, in 1930, I drove out to Bismarck with him when the original North Dakota Capitol burned about New Year's Eve. And he and I sat in Governor George Schaefer's home in the office at the governor's mansion that night and talked. And I just listened while the two of them talked about how was the legislature going to function. It was going to convene the next week. And So the rebuilding of the Capitol became somewhat of an early observation of how the political deals work. Then in 1932, I went to the University of North Dakota. I've been fairly isolated in Fargo. There hadn't been any leaguers in Fargo, and I joined a fraternity, and who was in the same freshman class with me, but Turner, I forget his first name now, and he was the son of the warden of the state penitentiary, and Vogel, who was the son of Langer's highway commissioner, Frank Vogel. And so I immediately was pointed out as being the anti-league part of the show. And so you learned right away that there is more to North Dakota politics than just the things you read about in the paper. It was inbred in these people. Yeah.
What were some of the things, the duties? Did you work for the Forum when you were in high school and college?
Oh, that got me started early in the summertime when we had a lake cottage. He would arrange for me to get 50 papers. Of course, I paid for them, and then I peddled the papers around the beach and then making 2.5 cents.
At Detroit Lakes.
At Detroit Lakes, yeah. At make 2.5 cents a copy, so I got into that. And then in those days, they still had the idea that the personal activities of their readers, wherever they might be in the area, was news. One paragraph items and who came to visit somebody at, for instance, a lake cottage, or who had a dinner. And I was drafted to write the Shoreham News. My sister, Catherine Bond, had done it before me. One of the big sources of information, of course, was our mother, who had been a society editor on the Grand Forks Herald for about 2 years, until she and Dad were married in 1913, and in those days, married people didn't continue to work. Married women didn't continue to work. So, but she had the background of being a society editor and knew what made news in those days. It was the same thing that I ran into when I came into work during the summer while still going to college, and they put me on the street, go get some little items for the news about town. I would go to the hotels, to the railroad station, and it wasn't really very strenuous. You'd ask if they had any news, and if they didn't have any news, you'd go to the next stop and pick up a few items and get to know the town.
Is it still done that way?
I don't think any major newspaper has done it for 30 or 40 years.
Then, after you went to the University of North Dakota, then did you graduate there? Or
no, I went 2 years there and then transferred to University of Minnesota. That was another choice deal. Dad said, well, let's drive down to the University of Missouri. That was then rated as the number one. He took me down there and we interviewed Dean Martin, who's the head of the college, and then dropped by U of M on the way back, and there was Ralph Casey, Dean, and I think the welcome was a little warmer in Minneapolis, and I decided to go there, and besides, it's driving distance and train distance. And
closer to home.
Well,
after your graduation, have you worked for any other newspaper
besides actually, before graduation, Minneapolis Star, which was the number three paper, it was evening paper, 6 days a week, competing against the Minneapolis Tribune and the Minneapolis Journal. Three different ownerships at that time. And the Star was getting along on starvation income, but they still needed to hire people, so they came out to the U of M and asked for somebody to work on the copy desk, editing copy, writing headlines, and I was pretty proficient at that in class, and I was recommended for the job and went to work about 2 months before graduation, but that had all been cleared with the school authority, so I still got my degree. And I stayed, and I worked there for until December of that year. About that time, the son of the dean of journalism at Missouri, Frank Martin, his son, came and worked at the Minneapolis Star along with me, and we started talking about taking a year off and going over to Shanghai. And sounded out my folks on that, and that when my dad came down and said, I think you'd better learn a little bit more about North Dakota if you're going to be interested in working for the forum. And so on January 1, 1937, I started my full-time work at the forum and on the copy desk. And that's when I got into the my first real touch of North Dakota politics, because my prime assignment was editing for the first 2 months the reports filed by Gerald Movius, the political writer at the time. And this was the session when Langer returned to office as governor. He had first been elected in 1932, and he was convicted of soliciting political funds from federal employees. The Supreme Court, federal court sentenced him to a year and a day. That made the charge a felony. It was just before the June 1934 primary election. I was in front of the courthouse, the old postal building in Fargo, and took a picture of Langer coming out after he had received this sentence and was pretty well splashed over. Page one, you did everything in those days. And but then, of course, Langer appealed. The conviction was thrown out, a new trial ordered. There was a hung jury, and then a third trial, and he was acquitted. So in 1936, he ran again for governor and was elected. And this is so 1937 when I was on the copy desk. He was making news.
Well,
it's a matter of, it's interesting to note that in this North Dakota 100 Years, a book of front pages published by the Forum recently, in the 1930s, 27 pages rated treatment. That's almost twice as many as any other decade from 1872 until the 1980s. All the news was to break. It was big news in those days.
When you say the headlines rated news, what do you mean?
I mean the front pages.
The front pages.
The front pages rated in being included in the collection of pages.
Oh, I see what you mean.
That just is the big news of the time.
Well, at that time, then when you came back from the University of Minnesota, then you were immediately assigned to North Dakota politics. And were you covering this at the time?
I was just reading copy, writing headlines.
All right. When
then, just from that next 2 years, I was just a general assignment reporter or copy desk fellow.
And then
Spike Movius, or Gerald Movius, who had been the political reporter, signed on with Senator Gerald Nye as his chief of staff in Washington. The political job was vacant, and once again, that man at the top, my dad, says, "You better try this." So out to Bismarck I went, and of course he was along to introduce me to those people who still regarded him as the greatest political reporter since time began, and he probably was.
He has had that reputation.
And he did, in his own biography that he wrote, he talks about his being assigned to Bismarck in 1909, and he writes, "So began a career as a legislative reporter in 1909 that was to continue without interruption for more than 20 years. And then that's when Movius began to write, and to which he returned from time to time as office personnel conditions required. His last work in that field was in 1945, when World War II depleted the staff to zero.
Well, then you were a reporter in Bismarck, or covering state politics until World War II.
I covered in those days you just went out for the legislative session. The rest of the time you were in Fargo. You were out there about 2.5 months every 2 years, and then you would travel back and forth as the events required.
So then World War II came.
But in 1939, that's 50 years ago, that's when I got my baptism in North Dakota politics. There was a new governor, a Democrat, John Moses. That wasn't too unusual in North Dakota because in the early 1900s, the man who kind of swiped the territorial capital from Yankton and got it planted in Bismarck, Alexander Mackenzie, he was just losing his touch, and another Democrat, John Burke, was elected governor for 6 years, and Dad got out there at the tail end of the Burke administration. It was the same year, 1909, that Usher Burdick started his political career as a member of the North Dakota House, the Burdick family is still going strong in politics while I'm out of the newspaper business. But,
World War II approached, and what was your experience then?
Well, okay, I covered the 39 and 41 legislative sessions, and I established good relationships with the legislative leaders, and it was interesting. I found, for instance, that nonpartisan leaguers weren't all bad. They were the same kind of people we were, but in some areas, to be anything, you had to be a leaguer. These leaguers served on school boards and city halls, and they got to Bismarck because they had this interest in doing their political service, their public service. So you begin to wipe out at the idea that one party was all bad and one party was all good. And of course you had a Democrat, the 1939 legislature had as members Senator Ondahl, later governor, and Ondahl appointed another member of the 1939 session to the U.S. Senate. When Gov Moses died after 2 years in office, he appointed Sen. Milton Young to Washington, and this was a time of, in the 41 session, Norman Brunsdale from Mayville was in the Senate, and he became governor after after Ondahl, and then okay, I had 4 years of service in the military, starting bush camp in Colorado, and I went down to Fort Snelling and waiting around for some kind of an assignment. I get called over to the headquarters of the reassignment group, and somebody says, "The captain wants to see you." Well, it turned out to be Ron Davies of Grand Forks, close friend of the family. And I'd met him up in Grand Forks when I was at UND, and he said, "Where do I want to go?" Well, I wanted to get in the Air Force, but nothing happened, so ultimately I got tired of sitting around Fort Snelling, and I just wanted to get out into basic training, and so in December again I was sent out to Camp Hale, Colorado. The new arrivals at this, it was a training post for the Norwegian ski troops, but I was limited service. I was not a skier, but the captain in charge of the new recruits looked him over and said, "What did you do before you were in the service?" I said, "I was a newspaper man." Well, Captain Thornley Wells of Moorhead said, "Well, military police is kind of public relations. Now you are a military policeman." And so that was my start. I got 6 months in Colorado, and then I applied for officer candidate school, was accepted, went to Washington, and after that, one of my first assignments delayed a little bit, but I wound up in the Presidio of San Francisco on about December 8, 1943. My stint as an enlisted man in the MP stayed with me. I was immediately put into the MPs in San Francisco and shifted from the Presidio of San Francisco with no more than a six-hour stop out to Stockton, where there was a detachment. Then there was realignments and training periods up at Camp Beale north of Sacramento. Back to Tom Patrol in San Francisco, and then I was given a detachment of about 12 men in San Jose, California, where there was traffic on both sides of the bay going up to the Navy stations on the east side and up to various installations on the west side up to San Francisco. And ultimately, the orders came through for overseas service and back to Camp Hill, back to Seattle, and the second, I sailed on about the day the first A-bomb dropped, and the second A-bomb dropped in the trip over to Honolulu. We landed in Honolulu on VJ Day, and I spent 6 months there before the planes dropped and I came home.
Well, that was not all bad. So then you returned to Fargo and went back to work on the newspaper.
Right. And okay, that was the middle of 1946, or about May or June. And they were right in the midst of the special election to fill the Senate seat that to which Young had been appointed. So the politics was hot and heavy right from the beginning. The because Moses had defeated Nye in 1944, Nye filed again as an independent, and the League put up its candidate, Dennis from West Fargo, I forget his name, but Senator Young, with the experience of being in office for about a year and a half, won election to the balance of the term, and stayed there until he retired in 1980, running in about 35 years. But this was, again, another blow to the league, because they had really controlled the Senate spot from 1922, when Lynn Frazier, the first league governor, was elected to the Senate. But then Langer and Frazier had a falling out, and Langer ran and shoved Frazier aside in 1940. And Langer was already then in Washington in 44, and he stayed there.
But during these days, were you on the political desk?
I was on, well, you were a one-man political reporter.
Because it's very obvious that politics and your journalistic career are very much intertwined.
For the a period, you carried along with the idea that the newspaper job was to make sure that the proper people got the right exposure, like Ondal. There was a mixture. I was a reporter, and I would also write editorials. These were in the days of page one editorials. So it was still a carryover of the political activity days. But as your staff reassembled after WW2, or you hired new people, you then got into the modern deal that there's a complete separation of editorial page attitudes from news reporting. In other words, your news reporting was factual without showing bias for one side or the other.
On your editorial page?
Supported those projects that you, projects or people who you thought were in the interest of the general public.
So that is the political bent of the newspaper is shown on the editorial page rather than on the news reporting.
That's right.
You at one time made the remark that politics was the reason for a newspaper's being at one time.
That's really before my experience with it, but all you have to do is go back and look at some of these older papers, not only in Fargo or North Dakota, but throughout the country. Politics was political parties supported one paper or the other. As a matter of fact, the Minneapolis Star, the third paper, was really started by the Nonpartisan League in Minnesota. And by the time I got there, that had all been washed away.
That was what it was.
Yeah, and the Nonpartisan League, for instance, owned the Courier Express in Fargo. And that later became the Morning Tribune, and it was purchased by the Forum in 1924, and at that point the Forum became Morning, Evening, and Sunday. Now it's just Morning and Sunday, right, as we've combined.
And the spectrum is not as politically oriented as it was.
There is a dedication to giving the people all of the news of politics that you can. In other words, you cover it thoroughly. You list all the bills that are passed.
The Forum has always been very proud of being able to disseminate the news throughout the state, even before television, very quickly. It was done by sending it through the mails.
That is one of the reasons that Mr. Black picked Fargo, because in the period from 1920s to way up to mid-60s, the mail was the way you distributed the paper. And trains ran through Fargo to the west and to the north, left here every night or every afternoon, and you could reach most of, well, there are some far corners that you never did reach, like the northeast corner and the northwest corner, but along the main lines of the Northern Pacific and its branch lines in the southeast quarter down to Oaks, and you would get there. And you'd get up to Grand Forks, over to Devil's Lake, and then there was the cutoff from Fargo to Minot. And that distribution system ultimately made the morning paper larger circulation than the evening paper, but the evening paper was the home delivery paper in Fargo itself. And so there was a...
So almost every place in the state got news next, within hours.
Yeah, but of course you had your other papers too, so it was... You didn't have any lock on your circulation, and it's... now, you still use the mail because it goes out of here at night by truck. Or you use your own trucks to get them out. But it gets tougher than it was when...
Sure.
Yeah. You know.
When did you become editor?
Well, the process, as I say, I'd volunteered... don't know what I mean. When I came back from the service, the pipeline was full on the day side, the city editor job, and whatever that would lead to more responsibility. So I suggested that what the paper needed was a night news editor to get the morning paper out and the Sunday. So I volunteered to go on the night side and was gladly accepted because they recognized that this was a place to go. And then I still continued covering politics, and it was, which can be done by telephone or et cetera, and a lot of political activities. So, but in 1950, or 51, the managing editor, Sid Hooper, died at an early age of cancer, and I moved into managing editor for both the morning and afternoon papers, and Dad was still there guiding his hand, and he was well regarded by staff, and he was on there working all the time or sending back memos. What most people don't realize is that the editor has got a responsibility. He wants to make sure that the paper comes out correctly, that the information it offers the public is correct. And unfortunately, so too many times the job as the editor is making sure that mistakes don't get in and reprimanding the people responsible for the mistakes, whether it's in spelling a name or not understanding what a tax levy means. It's a continuing job of educating the staff to make sure that the final product is informative and truthful and accurate. And so the editor becomes an overseer. And then he also gets involved in the coverage of things in which he knows more about. In other words, to be a good reporter, you must be a good reporter before you can be a good editor. And to be a good reporter, you have to spend your time in research. You have to know the law that applies to the particular situation. You have to know if you're covering water, which is one of my big assignments from 1946 until the end of my career.
As a concern, the garrison diversion and...
Garrison diversion, but you had, on top of that, Ashtabula Dam. You had all the little dams up along the Tongue River, and then you had Devil's Lake, and then you had the Souris River deal, and there's all of this water conservation has taken place in North Dakota in the last 40 years, it was all stories. But Garrison Dam was one of my big assignments, and I made a annual trip out there during its construction stage, and still waiting for it to be completed.
Between you and your father, you certainly have, and your work in the newspaper, you certainly have had a great overview of the growth of Fargo and the state. But let's talk about would you comment on your experience as the growth of Fargo?
Well, let's... when I was first on the state political assignment, my Fargo concerns were minimal, but as I moved into the managing editor positions, I found that local government was just as important, if not more so, than the state government. So you began to pay attention to what was happening in City Hall. I got involved with the campaign to build the current Memorial Auditorium and City Hall. Then they put me on the building committee for the auditorium, and now 30 years later they're saying what a poor job we did, but nobody recognizes that in 1957 this was, the voter says, you get this much money and no more, and you can't go beyond it. So that's why there are some areas in the auditorium that aren't as nice as they should be, but it was well accepted when it first went up, but then, of course, it didn't save downtown. Downtown moved out. And this has been a continuing problem. When I was in Bismarck in 49, there was a big effort passed to pass a law which limited the city in its annexation process. This was when the Red Owl was putting, or the, not the Red Owl, but wool growers were putting a big building out on West Main, and they wanted to avoid annexation, and they got it through a bill through the legislature to stop annexation when there was so much protest from the landowners involved. Well, that's when I was writing editorials along with covering the legislature, and the bill was passed in the dying days, and we put out a strong editorial urging Ondal to veto this particular bill. He did. That annexation went through. Later on, the bill passed again. But the process has been refined, so annexation now is pretty much handled as people require it.
Did that have anything to do with the change of allowing home rule?
Home rule was proposed actually by the legislature as a constitutional amendment, and then the legislature had to pass a law authorizing cities to proceed, and Fargo proceeded to adopt home rule, a limited home rule charter. And we supported it, but really it was limited, and the city didn't have all the leeway that it should have. So when I was invited after my retirement to get involved in a campaign, we suggested that the commission rewrite the charter, and I was named chairman of that rewrite committee, and
on the Constitution.
On the charter.
Charter, oh, I see.
And so the charter was accepted by the commission, put on the ballot, and approved in January 1986, and so the city has more leeway now. But you've got to make sure that they understand their strengths and their weaknesses, and so you keep in touch that way.
Well, certainly the Forum, besides being a newspaper of record for the city, has been a newspaper of record for the state.
Yes, this is where my dad was insistent. Get everything that happened. Put every bill in the paper. Show whether it is passed or not. And be thorough. Look at the record, the public records. I've got some clippings here from 1932. Cutting state bill or appropriations, another million may be the job for the Solons. 16 millions of state public funds tied up in industries. Then all the land that the state became owner of because of bad farm loans that the state bank and so it's a matter of detail of putting before the people the facts and the figures and showing what has actually happened. And
well, it's very apparent what your favorite area of journalism is.
Well, there's no question that politics and news go together. It starts from the Constitution when they put freedom of press in the Constitution, and it stayed that way.
How has the advent of television changed the newspaper?
I don't think it's changed the newspapers, except maybe they put in more news about television programs and personalities than you did in the days of the movies. Those days, the movies were kind of relegated to one page a week or something. But now, the TV schedules, et cetera, they're in there every day because they figure the people want them, and if they didn't serve them, somebody else would, and you would lose circulation. But on the gathering of the news, the explosion of the television crews for the news gathering purposes has hindered the newspaper. The reporter used to be able to go one-on-one with prominent news sources, whether you're talking about the governor or school superintendent. You could go in there and sit down for a half an hour and go over the story that you're ready. Now, the TV crews come in with the camera, the lights, and the public official has no choice but to have a news conference. And so the good reporters who've got the penetrating question for a newspaper, he doesn't speak up. He wants to get that answer for himself and not for everybody else. So you get kind of a hindrance in the collection. You've got a news conference is called by whoever, whether it's a candidate for office, and it's on the candidate's schedule, not on the reporter's schedule. And so the candidates or the public official is looking for exposure on 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock news. But the reporter would like to get it at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Well, would you say that the television reporter gets the quick bite and the newspaper reporter does the in-depth?
Well, there's no question that your newspaper gives you a more rounded picture of what is going on. It's got a place to put all the detail in, the statistics, the public record. If you tried to put that over TV, you'd drive listeners away by droves. And not everybody reads it in the newspaper. But the important people, those who want to know, do, and they want to see it in your paper.
You certainly have been in the middle of change from the beginning of your newspaper career until your retirement. But I can't believe that with your active mind that you're not still involved in some respect with journalism. Or is it all hunting and fishing?
No, of course, that's one of the things I left out. Along with my political writing, at the time I became the paper's golf reporter. So I'd move around the state to golf tournaments, and then our outdoor writer retired, and I became the outdoor writer for several years. You put everything together. You just weren't one or the other.
Indeed, you are not just one or the other. As I recall, you were appointed to the committee to have a revision of the Constitution of North Dakota.
I must correct you. I was elected.
You were elected. Good. Will you tell us about that, please?
That is the one political office for which I actually had to file papers, and it's the only one I've ever held, and it's the only one I intend to hold. This was the 1971, in late 1960, there was a constitutional amendment proposed and approved by the people. And with my 25 years of involvement in state government, I thought that I could add something to the discussions that would take place. So I filed for the job and was elected. In 1972, the Constitutional Convention met in Bismarck for approximately 2 months. We tried to bring the 1889 Constitution into focus for modern North Dakota. It wasn't a task that was too hard, but you kept running into problems that somebody didn't like, particularly this aspect of it, and the Constitution was presented, the new Constitution was presented in such a way they had to take it all or not, and the people voted it down. Since that time, the legislature has continued with the work done by the convention, and most of the proposals have been put on the ballot again and accepted by the people. The one facet that hasn't been approved is a complete reorganization of the executive branch of government. There has been no reduction in the number of elected state officers. There has been no cabinet formed, but changes have been made in the initiative and referendum process, increasing the number of voters, permitting the legislature to change salaries during a person's term of office rather than limiting them to no raises for the length of their term. I don't have all of the details there, but the Constitution has been revamped over the last 18 years to a major degree, and they're still working on some of the same ideas that we examined in 1972. Governor George Sinner, now in office, is asking for changes. He was a member of the Constitutional Convention from Cass County, Castleton, and everything has, government is a continuing process, and nothing stays the same, and that makes it one of the challenges. And I like the people who participate in it. They're willing to give their time, and I think politicians deserve a lot more credit than they get.
That's a very good word. Well, you have been extremely effective in the molding of public opinion in our city and in our state. I feel very privileged that we were able to catch you in this brief time between your hunting and your fishing and your politics to share your experiences in journalism with us. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.